I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table. You know, being in food media, Thanksgiving is honestly kind of the scourge of the job. I mean, not that I have anything against the holiday, I love it, but there is the inevitable annual groaning of, what do we do this year for our turkey stories? Do we try to come up with a new way to serve turkey? No, we don't, because no one actually wants a new way to serve turkey. We keep trying to come up with exciting new things, and what people really want is comforting sameness. Well, this year, honestly, who knows what people want? And I mean, whether we're talking about what's on the table or whether we're talking about how to get together at all. And for all that has been so hard this year, what can still ground us in our gratitude? That's what this episode's about. Us thinking, we have no answers, it's really just us thinking, but with some really amazing smart people, about what we can do this year to make us all feel like we're still connecting and sharing. Later in the show, we're going to talk with Deb Perlman from the Smitten Kitchen about how you can share food with people even if you're not at the same table. And we'll talk with the amazing Priya Parker, author of The Art of Gathering, about how to create new ways of coming together this year, ways that might make you feel closer to your people than ever before. And first, we start with Sam Sanders. Sam is the host of the NPR show It's Been a Minute, and I love listening to him with his guests. He brings so much out of them when he interviews them. Honestly, he really inspires me to be better at what I do. And, you know, I was listening to his show recently, and I got to thinking, in our normal lives, how can we make sure our conversations get deep and real? What can Sam teach us about how to talk with our people? Hey, Sam, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
I've been thinking a lot about our elders. And it's kind of what I want to talk to you about because,
yeah,
you know, we're thinking about Thanksgiving, we're thinking about the holidays, and you know, I've been thinking for sure about how a lot of families won't be physically getting together this year. And, you know, that also makes me think of all the stories that my grandparents never told me before they passed, you know, and all the stories my parents haven't told me yet. And I don't know, just this year I've been thinking so much about how I got to get in gear to make sure I get my family's stories.
Yeah.
You know, probably a lot of people are thinking that way. And so I wanted to talk with you since, you know, you're such an incredible and sensitive interviewer that brings so much out of your guests. And maybe we'll start from, how do you approach someone in your family to talk and gather their stories? Like, how would you get ready for that?
Yeah. You know, I think the first thing is like framing the event and the space and like kind of conceptualizing what you want to get out of it. So whenever I talk with people about Thanksgiving specifically and how to talk about perhaps politics around Thanksgiving, which I'm asked about a lot,
sure.
The assumption is that there will be these confrontations and that it will be a contentious dialogue with family that you don't actually like. Sure. So I appreciate you just even highlighting that you can make a holiday like Thanksgiving have good conversations, like those with your elders, about family history and fun, warm, heartfelt stuff.
Sure.
So that said, I think the first thing that I take into any conversation is that the first few minutes of any real interaction with someone where you have a goal in mind, you really have to prove to them that you care.
Mm.
And in my mind, I kind of think of it as just flattery. And the easiest way to flatter someone is to let them know that you've already done some research into them and who they are and what they care about.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you want to interview grandma or grandpa or uncle or auntie about their life. If you know where they grew up and what they were doing growing up, show that you have like Googled it. You know, like if you want to talk to grandpa about the war, say, I remember you were in this state during the war, and it seems as if this happened, but like show that you care and show that you researched at least a little bit. Like that goes so far. When I interview folks for my show, the easiest way to get them to really open up to you is to prove to them that you actually read the book or you actually saw the movie or you actually read the magazine profile of them. So I think that's the first way, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
People appreciate knowing that you like took time to think about them before the conversation. And it helps them invest a bit more in the conversation, because all of a sudden they're saying to themselves, oh my goodness, this little whippersnapper took some time to care about this thing that's part of my life and that I care about. I now owe them some of my time, and I now owe them my attention. And it just establishes a relationship around the conversation in a really quick and kind of easy way.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So I actually did this one time where I gathered some family members, an uncle, a great uncle, to ask them actually specifically about my grandfather. And mm-hmm. I actually conducted it as an interview. Like I brought a tape recorder with me and hit record. And the whole time I was pretty aware of the formality of the setting. Like I literally mm-hmm. said to my uncle, hey, I want to interview you, right? And yeah. I was fortunate in that he didn't seem weirded out by that. Having the tape recorder didn't put him off. But, you know, as you and I know, when we get into the studio, even with our guests, and often these guests are people who are accustomed to talking to people, you know, in public, in a sense, having the microphone, having a tape recorder, or just other trappings of formality, sometimes people react to that in a way that, I don't know, they just don't feel comfortable. They might not feel natural to them. How do you communicate to someone, hey, I really want to get a story from you? How do you soften that moment? How do you make that easier to get into?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question, because as we enter the Thanksgiving season, and sidebar, Thanksgiving's my favorite holiday because it's a lot cheaper than Christmas, but there's just as much food, if not more food. But the thing about Thanksgiving, it's this weird holiday in that we are asking people to come together and be families together. And the way that you really do that is through informality, right? But so much of Thanksgiving and the dinner and the celebration is full of formality. There was a big turkey in the middle of the table. The matriarch or the patriarch carves it. You all sit around the table, formally dressed, and you talk then and there. And that is not actually the way that families interact well, and that families show love for each other and actually talk to each other. I mean, you know this, man. Like, the place in the house where the conversations actually happen is not the dining room table. It's the kitchen. It's always the kitchen. The best conversations are going to happen as y'all are sitting around preparing the food, or, you know, up in the kitchen chopping the potatoes before the meal. The good conversation is not going to happen at the table. It's going to happen before or after. So I think in terms of, like, helping your elders perhaps feel more relaxed if you want to enter a conversation about family history with them, don't try to do it at the dining room table as the turkey is being served, right? Like, what are the spaces and places in your Thanksgiving rituals that feel a bit less formal? And I would also say that sometimes when you're trying to, like, record these histories, you can have the same conversation twice. You know, lots of times for my show, we'll have guests on and you hear the interview that we had on the show. But before that, there was a pre-interview. There was a conversation with them that wasn't recorded, in which we set the ground for the actual recorded interview. So if you're trying to talk to grandma, grandpa, auntie, uncle, I would plan to say, let the first interaction be informal, just a chat. While y'all are preparing food or on a phone call, and you raise the topic that you want to talk about and just hear them out. And once you've done that, maybe the next time you record it. And this does two things, right? Like, it helps get them a little loosened up. And it also does this really interesting thing that I find with all the folks that I talk to. When you ask people to tell a story more than once, they always tell it better the second time. They always do.
Oh, interesting.
You know, so like having the conversations spaced apart. So the first interaction about this thing should be informal, and you've got auntie or uncle telling you a bit of their history, and just like accept that as like an information dump. Soak it all in. And if you want to like formalize the interaction and record it, wait a few days, wait a week or two, and say, hey, I want to go back to that story you told me, and this time record it. Usually a few days afterwards, they can tell the same thing again, but it's a little more crystallized, a bit more streamlined, because they've thought about it, you know? But a lot of times, especially if you're trying to do like some kind of oral history or family history, you can wait to record it, and it doesn't have to happen in that first interaction. But I think my biggest bit of advice for folks trying to have heartfelt conversations with family around the holidays, whether they're older or younger or whatever, is think about the ways in which you can have that conversation be as informal as possible. You know, and what are the spaces in that Thanksgiving day? What are the places in that Thanksgiving day that can help them just feel like it's a loose and nice, relaxed chat? Whatever you do, don't bring up anything new at the dining room table at Thanksgiving dinner. That is, I'm sorry, it's a toxic place. It is a toxic place. It is a war zone. Like, I can't say this enough. Like, we have to let go of our conceptions of what the family dining room table means. It should mean less. It's just a weird place.
Yeah, that's not the place where, like, Mom, Dad, I have something to tell you.
Yeah, don't do it. No, well, then you see all these movies and TV shows where it's like, the young college student wants to come out over Thanksgiving dinner. Come on, man. There's a better way to do it. There's a better way to do it. Anyways, this is my pet peeve. You know, you mentioned trying to get them loosened up. What I found is a really interesting way to get folks loosened up, and I've learned this through the young kids in my life. Young kids are much more likely to open up and talk to you if there's some kind of secondary activity involved. Like, if you're trying to reach a little boy, y'all should, like, start playing soccer first or play some video games first. In the midst of doing that thing, they might open up more, right? Yeah. I think the same goes with folks in your family when you're asking them to really share some heartfelt stuff. Like, you probably would get them to open up more if you have the chat with them while y'all are both prepping the sweet potato casserole than if y'all are both just sitting still together, right? Having something to do with your hands as a kind of distraction in this weird way opens up folks to talk more, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, totally, totally, totally. That's why you have deep conversations while you're driving, right?
Exactly.
Like in your car.
The secondary activity. Yeah.
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 I love that. And actually, it makes me think, you know, a lot of people are going to have Zoom Thanksgivings of some kind this year. And maybe that time you do your chit-chat, but then if something comes up, if you can have a distance walk at another time or... Yeah, I don't know. It just makes me think of how do you create that other space to have those kind of conversations.
So I have a theory that's probably going to draw some eye rolls and some consternation and some maybe nasty emails. I don't believe in Zoom. Can I tell you why?
Please do.
And we are on a Zoom call right now to conduct this interview. But I think what I've learned in the midst of this pandemic, we've now been, you know, locked out of our workplaces for... what, 6 months now? I work from home all the time. Every interaction with all of my colleagues and all my interview guests is remote. The best and richest conversations in those settings happen when the camera is not on. I think a straight up phone call gives you a better conversation than the face-to-face video conference. There is a certain level of nervousness that comes for a lot of people when you're doing that because they feel like they owe you a certain kind of visual performance. Do I look okay? Oh, is my light good? Is my hair good? Am I showing that I'm engaged? Did I smile enough? Did I frown too much? I get nervous a lot of times now on video calls. And so what I do a lot of the times is I'll lobby to make what would be a video call a phone call. And, you know, kind of referencing back a previous answer, when you're on a phone call talking with someone, a coworker, a loved one, whoever, you can have that secondary activity going on. I pace the halls of my house when I'm on a phone call for work or for fun, and it just helps make me less nervous, you know? I find that when the camera's on, you're thinking about too much. You're not thinking about the words enough. You're also thinking about the visual too much.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I love it.
And you'll notice, Francis, for this call, for this Zoom call, I don't have my camera on. I never do.
Yeah.
But you look great.
It's been good talking with you, Sam. I'll talk to you later.
All right, man. Take care.
Sam Sanders is host of NPR's It's Been a Minute with Sam Sanders. Coming up, we'll chat food that travels with Deb Perelman, the beloved blogger and cookbook author from Smitten Kitchen. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. How are we staying connected? That's the question we've got on our minds right now. You know, back in the spring, the cookbook author Brian Terry told us about how he and his wife's family used to get together for dinner out once a week. But since the pandemic, what they started doing instead was find a local restaurant, order the same food and have it delivered to both their houses. They turn on their screens and they eat it together that way. You know, I love that so much. You know, the idea that there's something about eating the same food as someone, even if you're not physically with them, you know, it's still a way of feeling their presence. And so we got to thinking, what are some ways for us to share food even when we're apart? Deb Perelman is the best-selling author of the Smitten Kitchen Cookbook and Smitten Kitchen Every Day, and she's here to talk to us about some of her ideas. Hey, Deb.
Hi, Francis.
So let's start here. What do you usually do for Thanksgiving?
You know, I usually do a two-part Thanksgiving. We usually have a Friendsgiving over at our apartment where we kind of pack the apartment, which sounds so crazy in the age of COVID. We pack it with as many friends as we can fit. Our apartment's not that big. And we make a spectacular amount of food. And that's usually the weekend right before Thanksgiving. I love the idea of kind of setting off the holiday week correctly, whether you are excited to be with your family or whether it can be like a little bit, you know, stickier in some situations, but it always sets the mood nicely for the holidays.
Sure.
And then during the week, I adore my family, so that's not my situation. We have usually Thanksgiving at one of my cousin's house or my in-laws, so somebody will host. And then I'm always asked to send my menu over so we can replicate it because I've already tested it out a few days before.
Oh, right on. Like, you've seen the future. Just bring it back to us.
Exactly.
Like Prometheus, like, bringing
fire to man. We don't
want to
think about this. Exactly. Can you just send it over? But there's always foods that I feel like are so central to the experience. There are things that I make every year. There are things that my mother-in-law makes every year that, like, without them, it would be so sad. And yet I can't see myself making her butternut squash. Like, it's not my dish. It's not what I make. So if she wanted to, like bring that by the apartment, I would be so happy. So I love the idea of giving people pieces of like the holiday meal that you wouldn't otherwise make at home. I love the idea of being able to send that out to friends and family's home and also bring it into yours.
So is that your plan this year? Because, you know, like, it's one thing if we want to gift people food, which is always a lovely thing to do. But, you know, how do we think of ways to share our food with other people? And so, I mean, are you going to do that? Are you going to make the things that you would normally bring to Thanksgiving and like make portions of them, drive them around town? Like, that actually sounds kind of amazing.
I actually really want to do that. I think it would be I think it would be so much fun. There was actually a point in like early, I think like April, after we'd been home for so many weeks and we were getting a little stir crazy, I just made my like big favorite chocolate chip cookie recipe, and we literally drove from friend's apartment, left it on their doorknobs and told them to like come downstairs, and then like ran away. And it was super fun. And I totally plan on doing that again for at least the Friendsgiving portion of my holidays. And I could see doing it again with holiday cookies too. But I love the idea of doing savory. We so often think of gifts as being sweet, but I also think there is just when somebody makes like, if lasagna is like your December tradition for your big holiday meals, like it would be so great if you brought people pieces of it. It reheats well, it freezes well. I could definitely see, you know, it'd be so easy to make in smaller portions or take a large one and cut it up into four or six and bring it around to friends so everybody could eat the same thing.
Yeah.
And there are other things, like I love to make Parker House rolls. It's like so old school, but freshly baked rolls are just one of the great things on any holiday just, you know, winter dinner party feast. And I love the idea of either dropping off the pans of the rolls ready to bake with some instructions or even some sort of kit with the recipe on it where it's just, you know, because it's just butter and flour and salt and a little bit of sugar and some yeast. I mean, what if people could make them at home? I think it would be so lovely.
That's super lovely. It's like, you know, your own little meal kit. Well, I have to tell you, like, I'm lazy. So if you're going to do that for me, I'm happy to bake them, but...
So you want
make
me to,
it there
I
first.
Think that's fair. I can bring them ready to rise, like butter brushed. All you have to do is put the tin in the oven.
Yes.
I think that would be a probably more realistic thing than to assume, especially because if it's your thing that you make, like it would be nice if you actually made it, if possible.
Yeah.
I also, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to do this. I like, we always make this certain kind of spiced Manhattan for holiday stuff as sort of a...
Oh, cool.
Welcome drink. I could definitely see batching that cocktail and dropping it off in little jars too.
Oh,
it
yeah.
would be super nice.
Boozy claws.
Just exactly.
Just driving around big bottles of cocktails.
I was thinking little bottles, you know, a couple per person.
Okay.
We're not trying to get drunk texts at 5 o'clock in the morning. Although, I mean, that could happen too.
Relive our youth.
I mean, I have nowhere to be in the morning, truly, which has been true for many months now. So I can get in a little more trouble.
Wait, so what do you put in the spice Manhattan?
So basically you use, it's more of an old fashioned, but it's kind of like halfway between, but you basically make this simple syrup with a whole bunch of holiday spices in it. You can do the cinnamon stick. You might do a little anise. You might do like some orange peel. And then you use that to spice your bourbon, your warm, fuzzy bourbon drink. It's a really fun thing to do. I've also made, homemade versions of Irish cream several times. It's like one of my favorite things to gift people, but also we tend to just have it out because it keeps really well in the fridge, so it's nice to have when people come over, and it's such an easy thing to make for other people, and it's so much better, and it's just incredible that you can get this flavor at home from like so few ingredients.
Yeah. What's in the Irish cream?
Cream. There's actually some condensed milk. The sweetened condensed milk, really, it's like the mystery ingredient. Irish whiskey, and you're going to use a little bit of vanilla and just a tiny, tiny bit of cocoa powder in there. Just a little bit to make it.
Oh, cool.
It's like a very, very, very faint background flavor, but when you put it in, it really tastes like the real deal. And it's so delicious. I've also made it with rum before too, and coconut milk. There's like it's very holiday-ish, but even there's so many more savory things you can drop off too. Like, it would be so nice to give people like a jar of your custom spice rub, or if you make soup. I feel like one of the nicest gifts is like homemade chicken stock, or if you are gonna do something with a turkey, like a homemade turkey stock, like the kind of thing that's not really terribly hard to make, but not everybody's gonna do it for themselves.
Totally.
And also when you're at home too, and you're kind of missing some of your holiday or winter routines, like it's a nice way for you to like kind of be in the mood of things too, making some of the things that you'd be making anyway, and then just sending them out into the world. So it allows you to kind of like take care of the holiday and take care of yourself in a cozy, familiar way. Because I think it would be really hard to go all of this winter months without like celebrating with friends. It will be. And so I'm definitely going to be looking for ways that we can pull it off.
Deb, what do you think about like stuff you can set people up to do with them?
Oh, I love the idea of everybody making their own pie. But I also know from my lot of years on the internet listening to people talk about cooking and where their struggles are, that pie dough is one of these things that is such a struggle for people. I try to convince people that it's doable and it's simple, but I also am aware that if I could just drop off ready-made homemade pie dough, I would be like a hero. And from there,
the queen.
I feel like I have not too many friends are listening to this one, because I don't know about those logistics quite yet. I think it would be so fun if you dropped off even just rolled out homemade pie dough in a pie tin, and then we walked through making our favorite pumpkin pie or apple pie. What if you threw some apples and sugar into a bag? Especially like from a green market or something, or that like last can of pumpkin, there's always a run on them and nobody wants to go back to the store on Thanksgiving week or really any time right now. So, I think it would be so fun to make something like a pumpkin pie is actually just so simple to make. It'd be so fun to make that together. And then everybody gets to eat it. But I feel like the homemade pie crust really like raises the game on it. I think it would be a really fun thing to provide for people. You can also freeze them. And they freeze really well, and then it just needs to get back to like a refrigerator temperature for you to be able to roll it out.
Oh, that's so cool. If we are talking like more like just straight up gifting, are there things that you, I mean, I don't know how much shopping you do on the internet now. I have done so much more mail order shopping.
Everything comes in boxes. It's crazy.
Are there things that you like love to order that you would suggest people like get into ordering for other people?
Well, I mean, I have like my favorite, not that you can't make this at home, but my husband loves shrimp cocktail, and I have a certain like jarred cocktail sauce that I absolutely love the taste of. And I have ordered it before parties. I mean, I have recipes. I'm happy with my homemade one, but you know what? Sometimes it's also nice not to have to make that specific thing. Overall, though, I'm not a huge order. I've got like a few favorites. Like I have a favorite harissa, and I have a favorite like preserved lemon paste and stuff. But
lay them on us. What are they?
I love the New York shook. They're actually right in New York. I love both their harissa. It's so flavorful. And they make this preserved lemon paste, which is like, it's such a wonderful product because, I mean, if you're ever working with preserved lemons, the very first thing you do is you take one out of a jar and you mince it up. Like, what if you could just skip that part? I mean, I can barely think of a recipe where I've used one whole almost ever. So if you could just blend it up and then just use a spoonful and not have to put the rest back in the jar, or like figure out what to do with it. I love it. So it's such a brilliant product. Plus, when you already have a jar of it, like a condiment, you know, it's so much easier to just like tuck it into things like a vinaigrette or whatever that you feel like needs a little more body. I've stirred it into salty yogurt sauces. I've added it to marinades for both meat and vegetables. Really, it's this sour, slightly bitter, but also, you know, bright finish. And it has so much flavor in such a small package. And that's a reason it's such a popular ingredient in the world. But I mean, if you have the time and the lemons, preserved lemons are very easy to make at home too. And it makes it a really special homemade food gift. Also, this is deep in the baking zone, but I actually like to make my own vanilla extract too. And I've definitely done that as gifts. But that's the kind of thing you want to start on now, because you really want it to steep for at least 6 to 8 weeks to get a good flavor, and longer if you have it. So maybe start it for next year. I'm just kidding. We can definitely start it now.
And that's like just vanilla beans in alcohol? Like
I just put it in vodka. It's crazy. You would think that it would be amazing in bourbon, because we think of like bourbon vanilla beans, but I found the flavor and scent of bourbon kind of distracting, and actually the clear, odorlessness of vodka, like it showed it off better. But the price of vanilla beans is crazy expensive right now, so it may not be the right time for that kind of project. Somebody suggested to me a jar of caramelized onions. I love this idea so much. To make caramelized onions, which are, they're so delicious in so many foods. Like, what if you just did a giant batch, you put them in jars, and then you gave those to people? It's such a nice element. I mean, whether you put them into your biscuits, or whether you just add them to your turkey sandwich the next day, or you tuck them into your mashed potatoes, I feel like there's no way they won't be used.
Yeah, like real omelets, caramelized onions are just a phenomenal thing to have on hand.
They're so good. There's so much flavor. And I am, honestly, one of my favorite things are just ingredients that are really inexpensive and that you can really turn into something that's significantly better with just a little bit of cooking work. I mean, that's right in the sweet spot of where I feel like cooking should be.
Totally.
I also, I'm already thinking of like nominating friends, like which dishes they would normally bring to meals, like for the holidays. I always ask people when we're putting together a menu, like if this is Christmas Eve, or if this is Hanukkah, or if this is Thanksgiving or something, like what is the thing that it doesn't feel right to you if this dish isn't on the table? Like, that's your thing. That's your dish. That's the one you bring, because I'm going to make what I think should be on the table, but I'm not necessarily going to make like the baked beans that my friend from Boston will, or I won't make like the corn pudding that my friends from the Midwest like just can't believe that we don't have on the table. So I'm going to not so quietly nudge them to join this delivery service to bring some over. Wouldn't that be fun?
I love that. Either as a festive meal, or just so you have something for dinner on Tuesday. You don't have to think about it.
I also think that, you know, when people, nobody's generous in hopes of just getting generosity back, but there's something about it that fuels it forward. Because I might do a drop off here and there, but when you start getting it back, you're like, oh, this is a thing. We're going to do this. We're going to keep doing this. And then it makes it so much more fun. And I feel like that's very much in the spirit of the holidays, even if they don't look like they would in other years. I feel like this time of year, it would go really nicely.
Yeah. I mean, well, tell me this. I think early on there was this sense of, hey, we're all in a really weird situation. We're all kind of in the same boat to varying degrees, and people were really helping each other out, you know, be it virtually or just being, you know, supportive to one another in general. And I feel like we've kind of moved into a different phase of how we're sort of dealing with stuff.
It's tough.
I kind of feel like, getting back to a place where the opportunity for us to really create community, for us to be cooking for one another, to be making soup and sending it around, there was an opportunity, and still is. in this time for us to be creative in the ways that we reconnect.
I was also thinking about like participation. I mean, you don't have the hurdle of like traveling, buying tickets, figuring out hotels, whose house you're going to stay in, which nights, like how is this going to work, packing up all these presents. I think there's so many logistics to holiday travel. Nobody's like, holiday travel, it's my favorite. So if you spin it the other way, which is that you miss family and friends, but you also get to save some of the energy and maybe even money that you would have used for the traditional holiday, you really have this chance to really go hard on the stuff that you can do and like fully participate. In my family, we try to do these like big family reunions like every year or two, and we decided to do one virtually this summer, which was this whole thing. I mean, it was like 25 people, and I was thinking as we were doing it that we actually had total participation. Normally, somebody can't make it. Several people can't make it. How are you going to get everybody in the same place in the same time? But if all you have to do is go to your phone or your computer, it was so much fun. Like, now we're talking about doing it twice a year. Like, it's obviously going to be great to do it in person again, but, you know, at such a low cost and so little work involved, except for picking up your phone, which was unfortunately probably in all of our hands anyway. It was a really fun way to catch up and feel like close with people that it normally would have been a lot of work for it to happen if it had happened at all.
That's lovely.
Thanks. I hope we have this kind of cozy holiday. I hope we can find a way to make the most of the situation we're in.
Yeah. I kind of feel like we'll find a way. You know, I think if I have no other faith in humanity, I have faith in like how much we find pleasure and comfort and grounding in one another. And like, we just have to get back to that, because like, I think our like souls and bodies need it. So it was great to talk with you, Deb.
It was great to chat with you too.
Deb Perlman is the author of Smitten Kitchen Every Day, and she left us with a recipe for her perfect vegetable lasagna. Pack it up, people. You find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Priya Parker, author of The Art of Gathering, we'll talk about how to really get together, whether or not you're actually getting together. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Well, I guess we're not actually talking so much about cooking and eating this week, but we are thinking about how to come together with our families and friends. How different that is this year, especially for the holidays. And, you know, obviously it's hard, and it's really easy to focus on what's different, what you won't be able to do, especially if you can't visit your kids or your parents or someone else you love. But Priya Parker has a different way of looking at it. She's the author of The Art of Gathering, and she's the host of a terrific podcast called Together Apart. She is part business consultant, part philosopher, part emotional party planner. And we're so happy to have her here with us. Hey, Priya, it's so great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start by actually talking a little bit about you and how you got so interested in the idea of gathering.
So it's a good question. I come from a very mixed background. And, you know, my day job, my actual profession, is as a group conflict resolution facilitator. So I work with groups that are trying to navigate their way through like difficult moments, usually around lines of identity, so race or religion. And like I think many of us, I kind of either chose my profession or it chose me through my family story. And I'm biracial. My mother is Indian. My father is white American. And for the first kind of 10 years of their marriage, they met in Iowa, and they were kind of each other's source of adventure. My father's a hydrologist, my mother's an anthropologist. I was born in Zimbabwe. Cool. We moved every 6 months or a year to different places in Africa and Southeast Asia. And eventually they moved back to the States, to Virginia. And within a year, they separated. And within 2 years, they divorced. And within 3 years, they each had remarried other people. And they remarried people who in many ways kind of reflected the worldview from which they each originally came. And they had joint custody, and I'm their only child. And so every 2 weeks, I would go back and forth between these two households. And I would leave my mother and stepfather's house, which was this and still is a Indian, British, Buddhist, vegetarian, atheist, agnostic, unhopeful days, liberal, progressive family. And I would travel 1.4 miles across, like basically across 10 streets to enter my father and stepmother's home. And it was and still is a white American, evangelical Christian, conservative, Republican, twice a week church going, meat eating, softball playing family.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was deeply a part of both.
Yeah.
And, you know, my husband often jokes that it doesn't take a shrink to explain how I got into the field of conflict resolution. But from a very young age, I saw a couple of things. I saw, one, that culture and tradition and identity and group life is a combination of inherited and made up. Mm. And I knew that because I was part of a family for the early years of my life. And then that family broke apart and two new families were formed. Mm-hmm. And every 2 weeks I would go back and forth and enter these completely different realities. The way we started dinner together was different. Do you pray before? Do you say grace? Do you hold hands? Do you light a candle?
Yeah,
what brand tortillas are you buying? Are you buying tortillas? but also just worldview. And so my whole life, I've been really interested in when and why and how we come together and when and why and how we come apart. And I did end up becoming a facilitator of group dialogues. Mm-hmm. And what I learned in that training about how do you create, you know, meaningful connection in groups, how do you throw people off their scripts, how do you, you know, not have the, you know, the chatty volunteer take over the entire meeting, had nothing to do with what most of us were taught, like how to host, which in popular culture is often focuses on the things like you put the fish knives here, you put the wine mm-hmm. glass there, or like ramps are in season, you know, make sure you serve ramps this spring.
Hey, and you said you weren't a food person. Come on. Talking about ramps.
Exactly. And I was frankly very frustrated and kind of sad that hosting somehow had gotten like co-opted and it had become this somewhat elite sort of inaccessible world that people had a very specific image of what you need to be good at in order to create meaning. Mm. And I wanted to kind of shift the lens of how we understand what it means to create meaningful experiences together. And that's really the work of the Art of Gathering.
Yeah. And that's the title of your book, The Art of Gathering. But
yes,
the way you talk about it, to me it sounds as much a craft as it is an art, right? It's a practice. It's about doing things and learning to do them and getting better at them. And, you know, just a moment ago you talked about, you know, how do we kind of throw people off their scripts if your script is kind of rote? And, you know, this year, Thanksgiving and the holidays in general, everyone's thrown off their script, right? Because I think people are really feeling, I think how different it's going to be is really weighing on people. It's certainly weighing on me. And especially for holidays, especially for a day like Thanksgiving, I think a lot of people rely on the ritual and the structure yes. of the holiday. Like, we always go here. I always mm-hmm. make this. Certainly not everyone does it that way, but that's a big part of like the cultural story of Thanksgiving, right? It's about
Absolutely.
Tradition and doing this thing that, you know, stretches in your family for generations or whatever. So how do we help people find a new way to approach this and the other holidays this year?
So the biggest single mistake we make when we gather, whether it's for Thanksgiving or whether it's for a birthday party or whether it's for a staff meeting, is that we assume that the purpose is shared and obvious.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We all know why we're meeting as a staff. It's so, you know, it's so obvious. We do the same thing we always do. And people start going into autopilot. And actually, it's not clear why you're necessarily meeting as a staff or why you're, you know, what you're celebrating or marking for this 34th year of your birthday or this 74th year of your birthday.
Yeah, yeah.
And so our gatherings start to kind of bleed together and all feel the same. And this year, more than ever, in part because we are stripped away for many of us, from the tools that we tend to rely on to create ritual, the single most important question we can each ask ourselves and then our loved ones, our people, however you define who that is to first ask, like, what is the need this year? What is my need? What is our need? Like, what is the purpose of Thanksgiving?
Mm.
And what is the need for our family or our friend group or our people, again, in quotes, this year? And those are also two different questions. You know, the biggest way to begin to shift the way we gather is to not assume that the purpose is obvious or that the form is obvious, like it has to look a certain way.
Mm.
And to first ask, what is the need? And then how do we design an experience around that?
Okay. So if my need, though, is, man, I just haven't seen Uncle Carlos in a long time. I haven't seen Aunt Betty in a long time. I always look forward to this, you know, I'm bad about calling them, you know, da, 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 da. But I always know that every year at Thanksgiving, we come together and yep. I get to see them then. So that person approaches it differently than, you know, my need is, God, I'm just feeling lonely. And I felt lonely for 6 months. And yep. God, I'm going to feel so much more lonely knowing that, you know, I can't get together with my family, right? So like, those are two hypothetical situations, and I'm sure there are millions more. But if we talk about one of the probably most common, and I don't know if you would define this as a need, but one of the most common conditions that people might be running up against this year is the inability to physically get together. But they do want to have an experience that feels, I don't know, intimate, that feels like they're really in the presence of people yeah. they care about. What do you say to those people? I mean, the elephant in the room is Zoom, right? But but maybe it's not it. Maybe that's not the thing you got to do.
I think what I hear in your question is how do we create a sense of togetherness
mm-hmm.
if we decide we're not going to be in the same room?
Right.
And how do we create a sense of togetherness on this day of all days? And we happen to be talking about Thanksgiving, but this could also be true if it's Christmas or Hanukkah or New Year's Eve, because it's the same, right? These problems right. rhyme in a global pandemic. Right. And, you know, with we'll keep on Thanksgiving. If what you're wanting is to create a sense of connection, is to first ask, okay, that's my sense of connection. So then the second is, to whom and how do I want to connect with them? So for some people, it might be, this may be your 36th, you know, Thanksgiving with the exact same people every year. And the thing that's most important is we may change everything else and we may be on Zoom, but I want to be with those people. And even if they're not getting on an airplane, like those are the people that I want to create something with this year.
Mm-hmm.
And for others, it might, you know, you may bounce around to different Thanksgivings or you may bounce around to different friends or families. And to ask, like, what is it that I want to experience this day and what are we marking? And for many people, Thanksgiving is about gratitude. And if you pause and actually ask, you know, why do we do this in this way? What is the history of Thanksgiving? The first thing that might happen is you start digging into the history of Thanksgiving and realize that the myth, to use your earlier word, and the story around Thanksgiving isn't actually historically accurate. And so in some families, it might actually open a larger conversation to say, are we okay celebrating Thanksgiving now that we know that the, you know, what we were taught in third grade isn't exactly what happened, you know, between the settlers and the Native Americans. How might we still want to show gratitude? Is this the same type of ritual we want to celebrate? So for some families, it might actually go into kind of a rabbit hole of how do we as Americans now in 2020 want to mark a day of gratitude?
Sure.
For other people, I'll give an example. I know some families that are you know, making on their WhatsApp groups or their email threads, making a list of who's going to cook what. And in some contexts, every single person, so say you have 6 people or 8 people or 12 people, every single person is making their own Thanksgiving in their home with their like quarantine buddies or their family or whoever they're living with.
Yeah.
And then they're going to enter Zoom together with, you know, 12 mini feasts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know other families, and to me this is like very beautiful, who are going to make that same list of what you're going to serve at your table, and each person chooses one dish to prepare. And in part to honor and to mark that they're not together, one person eats beans, the green beans. And one family, you know, the person who always does the fried turkey, they get the rewards of the turkey. And I think, you know, I think there's so much of, and this is a particularly American trait of like optimism and positivity and kind of like this like joyful celebration despite everything, almost as a sense of escape. And I think that part of an element of creating meaning is to actually face and to see and to honor what is lacking. And so to me, the second approach of each person suffering a little bit, because we are all suffering. And, you know, to me, that's actually a more creative and real way of marking and honoring not just our togetherness, but this year our apartness.
Yeah.
And I think 2020 has been such a excruciating, crazy, transformative, you know, historic year, yeah, that we will all remember for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
And for some, that might mean for Thanksgiving or for Christmas or choose your holiday that, you know, we can't control anything else. And so what we're going to do is we're going to clench our teeth and do the exact same way that we've done every single year because it's the only thing we can control.
Mm-hmm.
But for others, and I think I'm more emotionally in this latter camp, it's actually creating rituals that mark, not in an over-the-top way, almost in a way that creates space for it, to say like, yeah, this is really different. And actually, the same way I wish I had turkey, and I'm using a lot of like traditional foods, but the same way I would wish I had turkey with these beans, I wish I had my sister-in-law here, and I don't, and I'm going to mark that. And then hopefully in 2025, everybody remembers Thanksgiving from 2020 and how we did it in this radically different way, right? And it doesn't mean you do it forever that way, but this year, given the events of this year, given where your family and friends are, what is the unique and specific need around which you might want to gather? And how do you do it in a way that feels true to your experience now?
Yeah. This is so... I love this. Thank you so much. I mean, like, obviously we were talking about Thanksgiving, but this is so freeing and exciting to be able to think of all of our, you know, ritualistic get-togethers this way. You know, I think it's worth, I mean, if nothing else, to your point, 2020 is a year where almost everything we assumed was true was put back under the microscope, right? Is that really true? Or have we learned new things about what we thought we knew? And
do we like, who am I? Who do I want to belong to? Do I like my work? Do I like who I've become? Do I like how I spend my time? Do I like how I mark time with others? Right? We've been asking this since early March. And I believe that even before a pandemic and well after it, those are the types of questions that allow for both an honoring of the parts you want to keep and a letting go of the parts you don't. Like when you start with the discipline of need, what is the need for these people right now? And how might we design or create something together that is relevant to all of us? Then it becomes freeing and joyful. And you actually might realize the parts of the ritual that you are deeply attached to and absolutely want to bring in into 2021. And it's a wonderful year to say, you know what? We haven't needed that part in years. And thank God I finally have an excuse to just let it go.
Yeah. Let it go and reinvent. Thank you so much, Priya.
Thank you so much for having me.
Priya Parker is the host of the podcast Together Apart and the author of The Art of Gathering, You can also sign up for her email newsletter at priyaparker.com. And I don't know about you, but after talking with Priya and Deb and Sam, I feel so inspired to find ways to connect to the people I care about. I hope you feel the same. Thanks as always for listening. Stay safe. Talk to you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. You can listen to all of our podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you like to get them. And this is a great time to sign up for our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. We deliver a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday. Makes dinner a little easier. That's at splendidtable.org. Our show comes together because of our team, Jenny Lubke, Erica Romero, and Sally Swift. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.